see people all the time that are 100, 200, 300 pounds overweight, and they return to normal weight, and their genetics don't change at all, and they're not taking drugs. They're changing their diet. When your kidneys deal with higher protein, they make it bigger.
Dr. Sean Baker,
the world-leading authority on treating disease with diet.
He wrote the first ever best-selling book, Carnivore Diet.
And has helped millions of people reverse chronic disease with a meat-based diet.
Nutrition has a huge role in the development of disease, prevention of disease, and in my view, the cure of disease. So they concluded that processed meat was class one carcinogen, unprocessed was class two. That decision was not unanimous. About a third of the people on that panel said, no, that's not correct. If we would just purely listen to what we've been told, people on a carnivore diet should all be very, very sick. We actually see the complete opposite on that. If you're doing a vegan diet for ethical reasons, you're causing a lot more animal suffering and death than you probably understand. One of the things that most people don't realize, because you think about meat, you're like, well, what about all these phytonutrients? I'm missing out on all these tannins and polyphenols. It's actually been shown now that meat actually has those things in those, and often in very significant quantities. In the beginning, it's not about restricting calories or eating less or worrying about weight loss.
So when it comes to Dr. Baker's best carnivore foods to eat,
I like ribeye steaks. I like fatty meat. I think beef and lamb are equally outstanding. Dairy products tend to be sort of on a gray area for many people. You can still overeat carnivore diet. You can still get fat on a carnivore diet. It's harder to do it.
When people start carnivore, what is the main thing they're doing wrong?
So I talk to a lot of people about the diet, and I think the number one thing.
This conversation with Dr. Sean Baker was one of the most important conversations I've had about root cause healing and why an animal-based diet is so important to fix so many diseases. And together on this health podcast, we have grown to over 200,000 subscribers in the last year. And that's given me the opportunity to interview the best doctors and the best health experts to give you the answers to so many health problems that our current healthcare system cannot fix. But can I ask for a favor? If you want to share this message that nutrition is the power to heal so many of our diseases, can I ask you to hit that subscribe button? This will help scale the message to more people in need. And in return, our team promises to bring you bigger and better guests. Thank you. Dr. Baker, welcome.
Well, Maria, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
When people hear about carnivore, you arguably have the most experience out of anyone on the planet. And millions of people have started the carnivore diet and cured diseases that doctors could not even fix, even with surgery. But when people Google the word carnivore, they're going to see things like carnivore is restrictive, it's dangerous, and it's going to increase the risk of heart disease, which is going to scare a lot of people from even starting this lifestyle. So in this episode, Dr. Sean Baker is going to prove why an animal-based diet is optimal, what people are doing wrong when they start a carnivore diet, and what happened when Dr. Baker tried fruit in his carnivore diet. But Dr. Baker, to kick things off, you wrote this book, Carnivore Diet, which put a name to this nutritional lifestyle. Why did you write that book?
Well, funnily enough, I was asked to write the book. It wasn't my intention to write the book. The publisher actually contacted me after I'd been on the Joe Rogan podcast for the first time, and was talking about my adventures in just eating a bunch of meat, which sounded crazy at the time. But they thought it might be worthy of a book, so they asked me to do that. And so I kind of reluctantly agreed to do it. I didn't, like I said, I'm not by training or desire a writer of any sort, but it ended up, and I had a nice editor, so we ended up putting together a pretty decent book, which was kind of written for just the average person that, it wasn't overly science to where it was difficult to read, but it had enough, I think, in there to keep it, reasonably credible. And so that's what led me to write it. So I wrote it, I wrote it probably primarily in 2018, and it was published in 2019. And honestly, I don't know that I would change it much at all. I mean, there's been some new studies that have come out since that time that I might have added just to further lend credence to the scientific argument for that. But honestly, I think it holds up today as good as it did back then. And I think it's a very good place for people wanting to, get started to utilize.
Absolutely. And I think that when it comes to nutrition, there's so much debate around what is the best diet. And I think that in your book, you spell it out very simply that meat is nutritious. It's not dangerous. It's important for us to eat meat. The question is, why has meat been demonized for so long?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, there's a long history in that. I mean, I mean, if we look at just from a nutrition perspective, you know, if we realize the founding of the American Dietetics Association way back in 1917, I mean, the founding members were all Seventh-day Adventists who had a sort of religious belief that meat was driving carnal lust and things like that. So they felt it was sinful to eat meat. So this is where the very foundations of our nutrition starts at, you know, at least as, you know, the nutrition science was based in that. And, you know, ever since then, you know, the nutrition science has been heavily populated by vegetarians and Seventh-day Adventists. They occupy a lot of the nutrition spaces. And so they've cleverly infiltrated much of the power structure when it comes to nutrition today. So there's the grounding of that. But in addition to that, I mean, there are legitimately people that have sort of ideological beliefs around meat, and meat eating is bad, and it's, you know, it's harming animals and those types of things. So that's sort of where I think the background comes from this sort of meat is bad sort of thing. And then much of the science has been, you know, done in an effort to sort of support that rather than to test it. I mean, we have a lot of science that kind of is done, you know, when you're doing science, it's not to prove a hypothesis, it's to test the hypothesis. And we've seen a lot of prove the hypothesis. We believe meat is bad for you, and therefore we're going to design studies that sort of support that rather than let's test if it really is. And that's really what we've seen over the years because, as you know, I mean, nutrition science, first of all, is very difficult to do and very difficult to do and obtain very specific, you know, conclusions. I mean, because most of it is inferences based on data, which is heavily confounded. And, you know, sometimes there are certainly biases inherent within the researchers. Sometimes the funding sources obviously get in the way there a little bit. But we've never really tested meat in a way that I think would actually show one way or the other. And we're sort of seeing that with people on a carnivore diet right now, because if we would just purely listen to what we've been told, people on a carnivore diet should all be very, very sick and should all be, you know, becoming, you know, disease very rapidly. And obviously that's not what we see. We actually see the complete opposite on that in most cases. So we have a... you know, the other thing is that meat is expensive to produce generally. It is a food that the profit margin is not very high on. And so there's huge, huge incentives to produce alternative proteins and alternative nutrition sources, which are much more profitable. And so we see that today. I mean, we see how the food industry is trying to redefine protein, and it's basically about market share, and it's not. You know, I mean, they claim it is to save the environment or help people's health, when really it's mostly about making profit, to be honest.
So when you say they, I wanted to ask about the USDA guidelines and even people that are on the advisory board of the USDA. There is a doctor called Dr. Fatima Stanford, and she has said that obesity is genetic, which kind of means there's nothing that we can do about it. Probably we have to take some drugs. Do you think that obesity is genetic?
No, I don't think, I don't think that's a primary. I think genetics will influence how people become obese and fat distribution and things like that. But I mean, to say it is a genetic disease, just, I mean, if it was, then we would have the same prevalence 100 years ago that we have today. And we know that, you know, the obesity rates are skyrocketing right now. And they didn't exist back then. I mean, there could be genetic, you know, modulators to obesity, but the direct cause of obesity is clearly, a lot of it has to do with what we're eating, for sure. And as far as USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, I mean, their job, literally, their primary job is to promote U.S. agriculture and commodity agriculture. So that means corn and wheat and sugar and soybeans and, you know, everything. So their job is to sell as many agriculture products as possible. The fact that 95% of that panel that will be determining the 2025 guidelines has financial conflicts of interest with various food industries, and particularly many of these processed food industries, is to say the least very disturbing. And so I know personally from trying to get research done through things like the Beef Checkoffs, which is part of the USDA They are basically told that they are not allowed to disparage any other commodity. So you cannot say with beef Chekhov dollars that perhaps sugar is bad. You're just not allowed to say that. That's part of their rule set. And, you know, the fact that, you know, Dr. Sanford is out there saying that there's nothing you can do. Literally, I mean, she said on an interview that you can eat all you can exercise as you want. You can eat as healthy as you want. It's not going to make a difference. You're still going to be obese. And I think that is a harmful message, quite honestly. And, you know, the fact that she has taken money from, you know, companies like Novo Nordisk, who makes Ozempic, you know, basically is, you know, clearly there's a conflict of interest there. And in my view, while, you know, genetics modify how you become obese, it is not the primary determinant at all. I mean, because there's, you know, I see people all the time that are 100, 200, 300 pounds overweight, and they return to normal weight, and their genetics don't change at all. It's obviously, and they're not taking drugs. They're changing their diet.
I guess people are confused about what should we eat because there's so many different ways of eating, carnivore, vegan, and there's an in-between diet. But talking about higher up before we get to these whole unprocessed food diets, ultra-processed foods. What is the problem with ultra-processed foods and why is that more harmful for our health?
Well, I think one is the processing of food. So when you turn things into powder, for instance, I mean, we are not really designed to eat powders. I mean, you think about it, just if we would go back even a few, well, I mean, out in the wild, if we were gathering food, I would not ever come across any kind of powdered food. I mean, that this doesn't exist in any form in nature. So it requires a tremendous amount of processing. And when you powder the food, sugars, flours, even protein powders, to be honest, you dramatically alter the absorption characteristic profile of those foods. And that changes how our gut microbiome interacts with it. It changes how the temporal sequence of digestion is supposed to occur. There's, you know, there's incretin hormones, which these new weight loss drugs, the GLP-1 receptor agonists sort of emphasize one of them called GLP-1. There's also GIP. Those things are occurring out of sequence. We also know that, you know, our microbiome can be responsible for consuming some of our food. They got to eat. And so when they're eating the food, we're not absorbing it, right? Basically, I mean, there's some conversion when it's fermented to short-chain fatty acids, but generally, because we're powderizing it, it gets absorbed very rapidly in the proximal or upper intestine, and the microbiome tends to not see as much of that. So we end up absorbing more calories, for one. The other thing is these ultra-processed foods have all kinds of ingredients that, you know, we would never normally run into. Thickeners, emulsifiers, preservatives, artificial flavors, artificial colors, on and on and on, of which many of them, by the way, are banned in places like where you are in Spain, in Europe, here in the U.S., most of which we don't really have good long-term data on with regard to autoimmune disease, for instance, mental health disorders. I mean, they test them for acute toxicity. They may look at genotoxicity, where we'll see if there's nuclear damage or something like that. But outside of that, there's not any real good long-term testing on that. So we have to sort of, we unleash it upon the population and then see what happens 20, 30 years later. It's the same thing that happened with this product Impossible Burger, where they have this soy leg hemoglobin, which was, you know, approved as generally recognized as safe based on a couple of rat studies, in which the rats kind of got sick anyway, and they still approved it. And so we have all these sort of weird ingredients that we clearly never would have eaten prior to even 100 years ago. So the effects that they may be having on us are, I would say, really unknown. And the other thing is they're hyperpalatable. I mean, they are literally designed. We have food engineers that literally their job is to make these foods addictive, and they know it, and they know how to do it. And they've got internal studies that show if I feed people this, they're going to want to eat more of it. And we see that with sugar. We see that with fat. We see that with salt. We see it with all these flavor additives that encourage that. So it drives unnatural appetite, unnatural eating. It's absorbed in a weird way. It has all these ingredients of which we don't really know what the hell they're doing to us. So that's kind of the general issue with ultra-processed food. Now, ultra-processed food and processed food are a little different. You know, grinding a burger patty is processing it. Cooking it is processing it. Me chewing something is processing it. So we do process things. But again, it's this ultra process. And I think there's a technical definition where it's five or more ingredients and they've been dramatically altered from their original form. And there's often ingredients that are not contained, let's say, within the average kitchen. I mean, I don't have any polysorbate 80 or mono and diglyceride sitting around in my kitchen cabinet, and most people don't. But this is what these sort of factories, adulterate the food with. And it's interesting to see that, some of it's done for shelf stability because, you know, if they can sit it on the shelf for 6 months or a year, they don't lose that product if it goes bad. So when I go to the store and say I want to buy some heavy cream, for instance, there is a version where it's just cream by itself. And then there's a version with cream plus, I don't know, xanthan gum or guar gum or carrageenan. And that costs almost half the price for the poison. You know, the poison version is cheaper. I'm kind of obviously being a little hyperbolic on the poison version, but it is a version that perhaps those things are problematic for us.
I think people are going to listen to that and think, oh my God, my heavy cream. I'm carnivore. I have to look at my ingredients. You do have to look at your ingredients. We're going to talk about best and worst foods, how to start carnivore. But it's important to understand there's ultra processed foods, there's processed foods. And then that goes into the next layer, which is, okay, I'm going to eat whole unprocessed foods, a healthy diet. The extremes are vegan, carnivore. I want to get your thoughts first on vegan.
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly there are people that improve their health by going vegan, at least in the short term. And for some, they actually can sustain it over a period of time. I think that the majority can't, but some do. And I think, obviously, excluding all those foods we previously talked about, all these ultra-processed foods, is going to generally be a net beneficial. Now, I think one of the things we often, there's characterizations of what a vegan looks like. Thin, usually, maybe somewhat emaciated, not very muscles. There's some truth to that. There are exceptions. Obviously, people can formulate that and take a lot of supplements and things like that and do a little better with that. But I mean, generally, it's difficult to extract a lot of nutrition from, say, particularly, fiber-rich foods, vegetation. It takes up a lot of room in your guts, and it may prevent you from consuming other foods. It may prevent, cause some level of satiety / some people it's bloating and discomfort, but it discourages you from overeating. You can eat a lot of it because there's very few calories in there. And then you just have, great big bowel movements multiple times a day. And most of that nutrition ends up in the toilet. So you're spending all this, perhaps a lot of money on organic fruits and vegetables, and a huge percentage of that nutrition ends up actually in the toilet, not absorbed, and you may lose weight that way. And some people may find that they like it, that they like that, and they prefer that. And there is, you can obviously have a tremendous amount of variety. There's, like I said, there's a lot of overweight, obese, sick vegans that are consuming, again, the ultra-processed food, the sugary vegan desserts and things of that, or the ultra-processed vegan cheeses and fake milks and whatnot. So that is, what I see with veganism. Now, again, there are a few people, a very small percentage, that sustain it and seem to be relatively healthy over a period of time. Although, we see as they get older and older, the likelihood of osteopenia, osteoporosis, fractures, sarcopenia certainly starts to set in. And so we rarely see what I consider vigorously well-muscled older vegans. I mean, there's exceptions, but generally we don't see that.
So with a vegan diet, because I'm thinking of somebody listening to this episode, they might be vegetarian or vegan out of ethical reasons, or maybe they're just born with that kind of lifestyle. What is missing in a vegan or a vegetarian diet that you can't get, that you have to eat meat?
Well, again, a vegetarian diet and a vegan diet can be very different. Obviously, a vegetarian diet, dairy, eggs, some people include fish in that. For some reason, they'll call it a vegetarian. I think that there are obviously B12 is one that most people are familiar with. I mean, there are certain vitamins and nutritional products that are difficult to obtain on a vegan diet. Not impossible, but difficult, and it's harder to do. And then there are certain things that you can't get, which are conditionally beneficial. Things like carnosine and creatine, carnitine to some degree. Those things have beneficial effects to the health, to the heart, to the brain, the musculoskeletal system, which the body endogenously produces some of it, but the numbers are very low. And so we see, like, for instance, there was a nice study out of Stanford University done in 2018 where they looked at people with a low serum carnitine levels, and plant-based people tend to have lower serum carnitine levels, they had a higher rate of major depressive disorder. And so you can get plenty of carnitine by eating, say, a steak or something like that. So those types of things. I mean, obviously, we hear about vitamin K2, vitamin D3, you know, but there's zinc is just zinc, leucine, lysine, all these amino acids, which are indispensable and very important. I mean, there's a leucine is kind of like the trigger for muscle protein synthesis, and it's harder to get on a plant. It's not that you can't get it, but it's just harder to. And so unless you are very diligent and you supplement adequately, and they're finding out more and more, you know, that more and more supplements are being added. Like recently, taurine was discovered as, a product that's found exclusively in meat, that or Red Bull, you know, if you want to drink the supplements, is also lacking in a vegan diet. And it also has benefits to our brain health. And so you're finding out that you're having to supplement more and more and more to get optimal nutrition. And also we're finding out that, well, we know that, you know, if you're doing a vegan diet for ethical reasons, you're causing a lot more animal suffering and death than you probably understand. And it's something that, you know, I think if you really look at it in depth, you'll understand that. And it may be more ethical just to eat, you know, a diet that includes meat, particularly if you are particular about how that meat is sourced. And that can be probably the most ethical thing you can do.
The great thing about you is that you're not anti anything, but you're giving a well-balanced, evidence-based approach. And you're favoring a meat-based diet, which goes nicely into carnivore. Now, there's different variations of carnivore, as you've probably seen over the last 5 to 6 years. What is the carnivore diet?
Well, you know, again, I wrote a book called The Carnivore Diet. I was kind of the first guy to really popularize it. And my definition is it's a diet that focuses on animal foods. You eliminate plant foods generally. I mean, some people will include a few herbs and spices, you know, as like a flavoring thing. But generally, it's animal products. I mean, that's pretty much what it is. And I know there's obviously different, like you said, different variations on that. Even in the book, I outline a couple different versions that may be appropriate for, say, some more than an autoimmune condition versus somebody that's just trying to lose a few pounds. And so,
if you want to make a shift towards optimal health with a carnivore diet, as you'll hear in this episode with Dr. Sean Baker, community is so important. And I know for myself, when I first started carnivore, I didn't have support. People were telling me that you're going to get a heart attack, and I couldn't find a doctor to help support me in my health journey to understand what I was going through. And that's why I partnered with Go Carnivore to bring you the world's biggest carnivore community. Every week we have carnivore doctors like Dr. Sean Baker, Dr. Elizabeth Bright, and Dr. Kilt. We have fat loss challenges, meal plans, and recipes, and also a list of over 800 carnivore and keto doctors to help support you and answer your medical questions. So if you'd like to learn more, just go to gocarnivore.com.
One of the things that most people don't realize, because you think about meat and you're like, well, what about all these phytonutrients? I'm missing out on all these tannins and polyphenols. It's actually been shown now that meat actually has those things in those, and often in very significant quantities. It's just never been really looked at. And there's some great work done by a guy named Stefan von Vliet, Frederick Provenza, who've shown that, particularly in animals that are fed a diverse forage. They have a tremendous amount of these so-called healthy phytonutrients that are in them. So you do tend to get that on a meat-based diet, particularly if you're eating whole cuts of meat. I mean, it's a really a reasonable way to get that.
When you're talking about whole cuts of meat and doing a carnivore diet, eating an animal-based diet, what do you think about processed meats? Because the World Health Organization says processed meat is a class 2 carcinogen. It's going to cause colon cancer. There's so many people that are going to see that.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, obviously processed meat has a lot of different nuance and variation within that. And so it's, what do you mean by processed meat? You know, is it some uncured bacon versus, you know, because you can go to the local grocery store, big box grocery store, and you'll get some prepackaged meat that is smothered in soybean oil and sugar and like 50 of those processed ingredients. And so there's a difference in what do you mean by processing? You know, if you go to, like, you're in Spain where they have lots of, you know, hams and cured meats, and those are technically processed, but if they're done kind of an older spot style where it's limited ingredients, maybe to some seasonings and some salt, I think that's a different picture altogether. And, you know, if we look at You know, again, WHO, World Health Organization, back in 2015 via the IARC, the International Association of Research on Cancer, had a 22-member panel where they concluded that, you know, processed meat was a class one carcinogen, unprocessed was class two. That decision was not unanimous. About a third of the people on that panel said, no, that's not correct. They threw out all the evidence that would discount that. And, you know, subsequently, there has been a huge amount of research that has shown that that is not necessarily set show. I mean, the group, the Nutrirex organization from 2019 showed that. Washington University, looking at the burden of disease study, showed that the data that has been based upon is very weak. It's just extremely weak evidence. It doesn't really have a strong signal. So it can be sort of thought of as it's weak evidence. The other thing is, you know, if we look at, like, for instance, studies out of Asia, which are very different, the way they consume their food in Asia is a little bit different than we do in Western societies. You know, most of the meat that is consumed in a Western sort of diet might be hamburgers, hot dogs, pizzas. Often they're consumed alongside other foods that are problematic. Whereas in Asia, these meats might be consumed as part of a stir fry, you know, with a bunch of vegetables, which are quote unquote supposedly healthy. They're probably healthier than obviously a Coke and French fries or something like that. So, there's a nice study out of Asia, was produced, I think, in 2019 or 2018, where they showed that, you know, all the data out of Asian studies don't really show a relationship to any type of meat, whether it's processed or unprocessed, and increased risk of colorectal cancer. I've cited that study many, many times. And so that was out of Korea, by the way. So it's one of those things where, again, it depends. What do you mean by process? What's it processed with? And I think that's really the issue, quite honestly, and how we consume our meat in general.
Okay. So when it comes to carnivore, I think another, before we get into the best tips to start and things that people do that might be ruining their carnivore results, I wanted to ask about research and evidence backing up a carnivore diet, because that's what people say. There's no long-term research. There's no evidence for it. Can you cite some evidence for people watching that might think, okay, I would like to try it. I'm doing it, but I'm not really sure for the long-term if it's safe. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, first of all, I would say, I would argue that there is no long-term research on any diet of sufficient rigor that would conclude one way or the other. I think that's just really hard research to do. We have some short-term studies that are either recently been published or are in the works right now. And in fact, I am actually actively working with several research groups to get a number of studies done right now this year, and hopefully they'll get started this year. Our company, Rivera, which maybe we'll talk about a little bit, will be doing our own research and publishing our data. Up to this point, you know, there was a study that Dave Ludwig out of Harvard was a senior author on, where it was a survey, and so it's not really like the end of the discussion, but it certainly showed that there are at least people doing the diet over a period of, you know, at least 6 months and up to 28 years, where their health seems to be doing quite well. And generally that the outcomes were quite good. There is a series of case reports that are coming out. There's one on eating disorders, several anorexics, which basically cured their anorexia, which is something that's just very difficult to do. There will soon be, probably within the next month or two, a study, another case series of people with inflammatory bowel disease, which put that completely in remission with a carnivore diet. There are Cleo Protegio at the University of California, Merced, and Frederick Lois out of Belgium put together another study a couple of years ago on carnivore, basically, you know, beliefs and motivations. And basically it was, again, more survey data. So, but we will be doing interventional trials, like I said, primarily probably against diabetes, because it's such a huge burden. We'll show that, because as you probably are aware, a lot of people go carnivore that are diabetic, and they literally put that disease in remission quite reliably. So we'll see that. Hopefully we'll also get some studies on some of these autoimmune conditions that are coming out. So, I mean, when we look at, like, there's always vegans saying, well, look at all these studies. Well, veganism started back in the 1940s, and there are literally organizations which have millions, if not billions of dollars, like the Adventist Health System. They have billions of dollars to do this research. And so that's why there's more research in that side. It's just because they've had the money. On the carnivore side, we have very little money. We're just a new sort of thing. And you know, as the studies come out, we'll start to see things change. And right now, I mean, but do you need a long-term study to tell you how to eat? I don't think you do. I don't. I mean, and if I'm going to wait till someone does a 50-year randomized control trial with twins locked in a metabolic ward to ultimately tell me what the right thing to eat, I'm going to wait forever. It's not going to happen. So I don't know that. I was criticized. I did a debate with this guy, Dr. Garth Davis, who's a vegan advocate. And one of the things I said was, I really don't know the long-term outcomes because I don't think it's knowable. And I'm being very honest with that. I don't know that we'll ever be able to definitively say this is the best way to eat on any diet. And so as I said that, I was criticized. Well, you don't even know the long-term results. Well, no one does. No one can know that. So what I feel is that where the biggest utility is with nutrition is, in my view, nutrition has a huge role in the development of disease, the prevention of disease, and in my view, the cure of disease. And so if I can take someone who is sick today and make them not sick tomorrow, then that is a huge win in my view. And I think that is where the emphasis is. And clearly people are becoming less sick or not sick while doing this diet. And, you know, in my suspicion, I think probably if you can remain not sick, you're probably going to live longer. I mean, I think that just intuitively makes sense. You know, can I say that with 100%? Certainly no. I mean, you get hit by a bus or struck by lightning or something. But I mean, I think instead of pretending we know how to make someone live to be 120 or 180, like some of these longevity gurus are claiming now, let's take these sick people, make them not sick, improve their quality of life, and have continue that as long as possible. I think that's the best we can really hope for realistically, you know, outside of, I don't know, uploading our brains into the cloud and living on as ethereal beings or something like that. I'm not sure.
I think people have that fear factor around, you don't know the long-term outcome. Does that mean that's something bad? But you've had a lot of benefit from a carnivore diet. What was life like before you started carnivore, and how did it change since you've been, you know, 95% carnivore these last 8 years?
So I started this, you know, I'm 57 now. So I started that when I was in my late 40s, 49 to be specific. And at that time, I had already been on a low carbohydrate diet. So I was getting some benefit. I felt my appetite was better. But the things I specifically noted was aches and pains that I'd had, particularly I had some pretty significant tendonitis in my right knee. That resolved after about 2 months. I noticed my digestion improved tremendously because I was eating on a ketogenic diet. I was eating, obviously, low carb, lots and lots of salads and giant spinach salads and things like that. And I'd always had, you know, just digestion, which wasn't bad, but I could just tell. Well, I mean, I thought that was normal for me. I didn't realize it was a problem until it went away. Then I was like, wow, this is what it feels like to not, you know, not even notice you're digesting food, which I thought was kind of strange because I'd always, you know, you'd eat and then you'd kind of know things were going on. And then at that point it was like, did I eat anything? I can't even tell. There's no such things like that. I thought my energy was better. Athletically, I got stronger. I got leaner. And so, I mean, in the, you know, as I said, I'm an older guy, and in the 8 years that I've been doing this carnivore diet, I've gotten quite a fair bit stronger. And I was already an athlete. I was already a strong guy back then. I mean, there's nobody who would have said, oh, you're a weakling, but I was quite strong, quite athletic, but I just got better. And I've been able to set multiple world records in different events, you know, primarily in rowing and things like that. But so it's been quite beneficial, you know, for me personally. And then obviously the biggest benefit I've had was being able to share it with other people and see the tremendous life altering, you know, for the better results that I've seen on a daily basis, which is really, really what really gives me a lot of joy to see that.
I think so many people look to you as the absolute expert on the carnivore diet, given that you wrote the book and you have a lot of experience. I think people, when they start carnivore, they need a bit of guidance. And depending on you, who you talk to, there's going to be different approaches to start. What do you see when people start carnivore? What is the main thing they're doing wrong?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of people that you know, when so I talk to a lot of people about the diet, and I think the number one thing, a lot of people start it for a reason. Hey, I'm depressed, I'm overweight, I've got an autoimmune disease, and that's fine. It can work for that. But I think until you address, I mean, you probably didn't get that way by eating a carnivore diet. Clearly, most people have been eating this. And most people struggle with eating the wrong foods, and it's hard to stop. And like I mentioned, the food companies are literally designing foods that are addictive for us. And so I think that the biggest thing that I tell people is, let's work on overcoming that. And so in the beginning, it's not about restricting calories or eating less or worrying about weight loss. Change your relationship with the food, you know, so that you eat enough. I tell people, eat enough so you don't want the cupcakes or the pizzas or things like that. So you just do that. And so a lot of people, you know, they go, I'm on a diet, I'm going to lose weight, I'm going to restrict things. And then, you know, that's where you get into trouble in many cases, because, you know, your energy is low. Maybe you end things, maybe your hair starts to fall out for some people. You know, you just don't feel very good. And then you're always starving because you're like, I can't do this. There's too much stuff around me. So I think that's probably the number one thing that I see as an approach that is beneficial. So just almost intentionally, I wrote in the book, eat meat like it's your job in the beginning, because it kind of is for a while. And then once you've kind of reached that point, wherever that is, 2 months down the road, 6 months down the road, where you've kind of changed how you perceive nutrition, then you can start to dial in and work on, you know, weight loss goals or some of these other, a lot of these things will happen naturally, but on their own. A lot of people find even if they eat till they're completely full, they often lose weight, which is kind of interesting, you know, it's often very liberating, because, you know, a lot of people complain about the carnivore diet being very restrictive, but a lot of people find it's actually very freeing, because they're not constantly thinking about food, and they don't have these food intrusive thoughts all the time where they're thinking about, I just ate breakfast, what am I going to have for lunch? I say lunch, what am I going to have for dinner? Where am I going to go? Let's go to this new restaurant. Let me try this new recipe. Constantly scrolling, looking for ideas to eat. That kind of goes away. It's kind of like, and it's kind of freedom from that. It's kind of freedom from really an addiction. And I think that's the very early message that I think a lot of people have to get. And then, of course, there's, you know, some of the technical, you know, making sure you're hydrated, realizing that your digestion is going to change, and that there's some periods that go with that. How do you incorporate exercise and those types of things? So there are some considerations. And I think the other thing that's really important is having a supportive environment, because when you are on a diet and you're constantly inundated with, oh, you shouldn't eat that, it's going to kill you, or it's bad for you, or it's bad for the planet, or you don't have support. In fact, when I did a survey on 12,000 people doing the diet, and one of the questions we asked was, how supported are you either with your friends and family, work, or with your physician? And those that felt supported were much more likely to have success. It was like a 30% increase in their likelihood of obtaining success. So finding if you don't have a local support structure, like friends and family that support you, at least find a community. That's why a lot of these online groups are so beneficial. And they help people with regard to, you know, motivation, accountability, questions, just having a friend, having someone you can talk to, sharing ideas. Those things become very important. And that's why I've been doing it for so long. In fact, right after this, I go to my meeting where I just, every single day, 365 days a year, unless I'm on a plane, I'm in a meeting trying to support these people, because it is a long-term prospect for many. Not every, some people you can say, hey, here's what you do, and they go, and they're fine, and they can do it. A lot of other people, they just need that continual feedback, which, you know, I'm happy to provide, and I think it's important.
So when it comes to Dr. Baker's best carnivore foods to eat for optimal health, what would the best foods be?
You've got to enjoy, like I like ribeye steaks, you know, I like fatty meat. I mean, that for me, that to me is a pinnacle of, you know, satiation, satiety. I think it has tremendously health benefits to it. And so, but at the end of the day, you've got to actually enjoy it. And I know there are people that say, I just don't like that much fat. And I think you have to just sort of dial in what you like. I think red ruminant meat tends to be what most people tend to go for and tolerate the best. So I mean, certainly that's up there. I think beyond that, then you start getting into, you know, other cuts of meat, you know, whether it's, I think beef and lamb are equally outstanding, by the way. Then, you know, you get into the, you know, seafood and the, you know, non-ruminant animals such as, you know, pork and, you know, maybe some of the poultry like duck and chicken and things like that, which I know people variably prefer. Dairy products tend to be sort of on a gray area for many people. I think some people can do well with them. Some people, depends on the type of dairy, obviously, whether it's, you know, how much the proteins are in there. You know, some, like ghee, for instance, is probably the most well-tolerated dairy product that I can think of, just because it's, you know, clarified butter with all the milk solids out of it. And so, I mean, I think those things tend to be favored by most people. You know, I'm not someone that, again, we can talk about, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning, I had added fruit to my diet for a period of time. That was literally for a week, and it was just to test a cholesterol shift and see if it was going to change my cholesterol or not. And it's not for me. I don't do well with that. And so I tend to eat what I enjoy and what makes me feel the best. And so that's how I, you know, sort of live my life and sort of participate in my nutrition. It's like, I got to like it, and it's got to sit well with me.
So what happened to you after a week of eating? I think it was apples that you ate every day.
Yeah. So the reason I did that was, you know, there's a guy named Nick Norwitz who's, he's got a PhD from Oxford University in the UK. And now he's doing his medical training up at Harvard. And he is a big proponent he's a lean mass hyper responder, you know, this concept of being very lean on a low carb diet and having very high levels of particularly total and LDL cholesterol. And he has shown, and it's been shown many, many, many times now, that in that situation, adding carbohydrates back in to refill your glycogen stores leads to less trafficking of fat from the liver into the blood. So your cholesterol will go down. He demonstrated that very, very nicely. And it's, you know, like I said, Adrian Sotomoto, who's another Oxford researcher, has shown that people on low carb diets, being lean is the biggest determinant of how high your cholesterol might go. So I, in an effort for just to see what would happen to me, because my cholesterol is not super high. It's higher than most people would like, but it's not like ridiculously high. But I thought, well, let me try to add in and do my own experiment. I don't want to eat Oreo cookies because, you know, it's, you know, I thought fruit would be a little less, you know, less of a problem. And so I added up 100 grams, which is about 4 apples a day. An apple is about 25 grams of carbohydrates. So I added that in to my diet, and I hadn't had, you know, that's probably that those 7 days or six or seven or eight days, I can't remember. I think it was about 8 days I did it. Were probably more fruit than I've had in 8 years. I mean, like the total, that's like the total amount. And a couple of days I felt okay. By about day three, four, I started to notice that my stomach was just feeling a little bit like irritated. And by about a weekend, I was like, I'm just having too much gut issues. I don't want to do this. And I didn't, you know, I wasn't really doing it for any other benefit. I didn't feel like it would help me athletically. I didn't feel a need to do it. It was just an experiment to see what happened with the cholesterol. And it didn't really do much, which is kind of funny. It didn't really do much to my cholesterol, and probably because I am big right now. I'm heavy. I'm not super lean. I mean, you wouldn't look at me and say I was a fat guy, but I'm not like lean where I think that would have the difference, because I eat enough to where my glycogen is generally topped off via gluconeogenesis from the protein and fat I'm consuming. So I didn't really have a problem. I probably wasn't in a glycogen depleted state. Interestingly, and I'll share that, after that experiment, and I realized it didn't do it, I wanted to see how fasting would impact my cholesterol. And it goes with this, because when I did fast long enough to deplete my glycogen, so that was about a 38-hour fast, the day before my total cholesterol was 156 milligrams per deciliter, which is considered fine. Most doctors would say, well, that's a perfect cholesterol level. I fasted for 37 or 8 hours, and the next day, it went from 156 up to 346. So almost a 200-point jump in under 24 hours, which, you know, that's alarming that it could jump that high, because, you know, we're making decisions, lifetime decisions. You know, this is on a Monday. If I went to the doctor on Monday when my total cholesterol was 156, he would have patted me on the back and said, hey, good job. But I came back on Tuesday, he'd be like, oh my God, we need to put you on a statin and call the cardiologist. And you know, so it's just how crazy we make these decisions based on one single lab value. And that's why when people ask me about labs, I kind of like, you know, it depends what else is going on. There's a lot of variability there. I'm not too excited about those numbers, because very often, you know, without the clinical context, and very often that's not really looked into. I mean, when you go to the doctor and you come back and your LDL cholesterol is 150, they're going to say, here, statin. They're not going to ask you, hey, what did you eat the last couple of days? Have you been exercising? That's not ever part of the discussion. And it should be, quite honestly, but it's not.
Let's talk about blood glucose, because I think that when people start a carnivore diet, I see this a lot on my community. They are otherwise healthy, all their markers are fine. And then one member said, oh, my blood glucose went up to 120. My fasting, my A1C is 6.2. Everything else is fine.
Well, I mean, with regard to the fasting blood glucose, and this is something that I think is, you know, when we talk about fasting, what does it actually mean? Well, fasting should mean that you have nothing in your gut. So you're truly postprandial, you're truly in a fasting state. And when you're consuming, say, a steak, it's going to sit in your gut and take a long time to transit through. And that's by intention. You know, these new drugs, the GLP-1 receptor agonists, the GLP-1s, I mean, when meat and beef goes into our gut, it stimulates GLP, which slows our gut down so that we can have more time to fully absorb that nutrition. So I think a lot of people, particularly when it comes to fasting, number, you need to fast longer to get a truly fasted glucose number. So an overnight fast of 12, 14 hours after a steak might not be long enough. And so you may still be postprandial. So I would say maybe 18 hours, maybe even 24 hours to really get a fasting number. There is, you know, depending on what this person's background was, maybe they were pre-diabetic, maybe they had some diabetic pathophysiology going on. And so we always have, I mean, there's also this so-called Somogyi effect or dawn effect that occurs and where glucose in the morning rises. There is data coming out now that depending on what the person does, we know like for instance, elite level athletes, like professional cyclists and ultra marathon people will see their blood glucose. Some of them will see it skyrocket to, 300, 400, milligrams per deciliter, which is incredibly high. And some of those people actually have higher postprandial glucose responses as athletes. And so I think we're learning that there is a little bit more subtlety to this. It's not necessarily what's going on with that person, but I the other thing is that we know that A1C is generally considered a 3-month, you know, assessment of what our glucose has been. However, that's assuming a red cell lives 3 months. And sometimes these red blood cells live longer. And then if they're living for longer, they're going to have more glycosylation occurring. And so so we have maybe artificially elevated A1C. So sometimes things like a finger stick or CGM, if you have the luxury of getting that, can sort of show you that, wait a minute, these things aren't lining up. And maybe my blood glucose isn't as high as I think it is. So there could be a number of things going on. It could be, you know, depending on what's going on with the person's weight, if they're gaining weight, I mean, it could just be they're over-consuming, because, I mean, a lot of times blood glucose represents overall energy status. And so if you are, you know, I mean, I know I talk about eating a lot on carnivore initially, but I mean, there's a point where some people do, even on a carnivore, overeat, and that can be shown in things like blood glucose. So there's, I mean, it, like I said, you can still overeat carnivore diet. You can still get fat on a carnivore diet. It's harder to do it. And sometimes, it's very hard, but it can happen and does happen from time to time.
I'm glad that you said that, because I think people think that when they go carnivore, they're just going to lose weight. And then there's all these questions, why am I gaining weight? Like it's some sort of like shock horror thing, but it's optimal nutrition. And that's why if you eat more, because maybe your hormones need it, that's why you could be gaining weight. The last question I want to ask also is about kidneys. Does protein or heavy protein diet affect the kidneys?
Yeah, often in a beneficial way, to be honest. I mean, there's data out there. I mean, my friend David Unwin in the UK has shown in his population of chronic kidney disease, diabetics with chronic kidney disease, that a higher protein diet actually reverses that. There is a misconception that higher protein diet damages kidneys based upon something called the Brenner hypothesis. This is a Dr. Brenner from the 1980s, I believe, showed that in animals, particularly rodents, mice and rats, that high protein diets actually cause glomerular damage. And that was associated with kidney disease. And we do know that when humans do go into kidney failure, they will spill more protein. And so we associate protein as being stressful to the kidneys or being associated with kidney disease. However, it's not the protein that's causing the damage. It's often diabetes is probably the number one cause, prediabetes, insulin resistance, is probably the number one reason for kidney failure. So higher protein diets, I mean, one of the thoughts is it causes more sort of hyperfiltration and stress going on in the kidney, which there is some truth to that. But it's kind of like the analogy that exercise makes my muscles get bigger. And that, is that bad? Is that stress? Is that a eustress? We know that, like, for instance, pregnant women, their kidneys get bigger. We know this if you have a nephrectomy and you lose one of your kidneys, your other kidney will have compensatory enlargement. And so when your kidneys deal with higher protein, they make it bigger. And you know, I don't think that's a problem. In fact, what we see in old people as they shrivel up and die and they become anorexic and cachectic and sarcopenic and their brain shrinks, all their organs shrink down. That's a sign of impending death. So having big, plump organs is not necessarily a problem. I mean, there are some exceptions. You know, there's a tumor or something like that, or enlarged livers for some reason if they're very fatty. But it's not generally the issue. I mean, I think Stu Phillips has a wonderful paper in 2018 looking at a huge systematic review of higher protein diets versus lower protein diets. And this is in healthy people, no effect on negatively with kidney damage. Jose Antonio has done studies on guys that are, you know, bodybuilder types that were consuming massive amounts of protein. We're talking 3, 4, 5 grams per kilogram of body weight of protein with no evidence of renal damage, liver damage. So I think it is a unfortunate thing that is, again, drawn from these epidemiological associational data and the fact that we observe protein spilling in people with kidney failure, not that the protein is necessarily causing that. So I think, you know, if your high protein diet is also in conjunction with an ultra processed food diet, then that could be a problem. But I mean, I think the problem really is, what are those other things you're consuming? And I think you know, a meat-based diet plus junk food is miles apart different from a meat-based diet plus no junk food. That's a huge difference. And so I think we have to look at it in those terms.
Absolutely. I think a last thing that people, they want to find a carnivore or a keto doctor that understands what they're going through, their labs, and how to interpret their results. How are you helping to help in that connection to find doctors and get support?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of people who can go on a carnivore diet don't really need a doctor. I mean, if you're pretty healthy, you know, but if you're on a lot of medications, if you're diabetic, if you're on hypertensive medicines, you know, antidepressants, things like that, a lot of times you have to be careful because, you know, you can become hypoglycemic, you can become hypotensive. There is some nuance on how to deprescribe medications. And so I am a co-founder of a company called Rivero, and we have physicians licensed in all 50 states. We just opened for business a little over a month ago, and we have something like 8,000 people on our waiting list. And it's really exciting to me because every clinician that we've hired, and we're hiring more all the time, gets it. They are totally, many of them have done carnivore diets, they're very supportive of that. It's not the only thing we will do. We will generally be low carb. We're focusing on elimination diets, and some people will go carnivore if they need to. But you know, that a lot of people like that they've got a physician that's not going to fight them or not going to, I mean, we're still going to be responsible, and we still have to practice within the confines of the legal system for medicine. And so it's a huge undertaking. We spent millions of dollars putting this together. And I'm very excited to see how this goes, because I think medicine is at a point where, one, a lot of people are frustrated with it. Two, we see that the paradigm and where it's going. I mean, what you'll see with conventional medicine over the next decade or so will be a greater and greater shift towards automated care. We'll have AI. You may interact on the computer with an algorithm, and you know, you may stick your finger into a little machine that you might have an adapter at home that draws your blood. It can analyze it, sends it off. The AI will diagnose you, and drugs will come to your house tomorrow. That is what they're working towards. Whereas a physician, maybe in the background, might oversee and sign something off that you'll never really interact with. And it'll be a great thing for the drug companies, because they'll just be able to get more drugs into people's hands without having to go through those pesky doctors that they have to wine and dine and bring donuts to their office staff and that type of stuff. So we'll see this less and less of a barrier between the drug companies and the the customers, if you will, or the addicts, as you might say, you might want to describe them. And that's going to happen. And we're going to see that. And it's going to cost, it's going to save some money. And it's going to keep more people medicated, which arguably is a bad thing, depending on your perspective, versus what we'll be doing, which will be obviously a lot of, I think treating disease requires a lot of support. And the fact that we have physicians overseeing it, we have coaching staff, you know, we have, which provide almost daily feedback in many cases. We have a tech platform that is driven to encourage you to be successful. So that's what we're doing with Rivero. And I'm super excited about this. You know, we have a dedicated research team. We'll be publishing our data as research. So, you know, this is a way to change sort of the healthcare paradigm. So I'm excited about that very much. So
how can people find out more about Rivero?
Yeah, just go to rivero.com. So R-E-V-E-R-O.com. There's a waiting list. We have something like nearly 9,000 people on that waiting list, and we are contacting them. You know, we had people sign up for the last several months, and now we're reaching out to contact them as we are able to accept more and more. Initially, we contacted a very few amount because we wanted to make sure that the systems were working like we expected them to. Because anytime you start something new, you always find, hey, we need to fix this or that. And we've been doing that. So now we're at the point where we're going to start enlarging our scaling. And then, yeah, so if you go to Rivero.com, get on the waiting list. The quicker you get on, the quicker you'll have at, the quicker we'll be able to get to you. And I would say over the next, I don't know, few months, 3-4 months, we should have contacted hopefully all of our people. And then we're hiring as we scale up. You know, we've got hundreds of doctors and clinicians waiting to join us, which is, that really is exciting to just think there's that many like-minded physicians out there and that you want to do the right thing, which I think this is.
I'm going to leave the link for Rivero in the description of this video. So if you're interested, because if you need a carnivore doctor or advice or coaching, I'm going to leave that link. And of course, it's co-founded by Dr. Sean Baker, and we love Dr. Baker. Dr. Baker, thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful. How can people find you specifically if they want to hear and learn from you more?
Yeah, so I've got, social media on several platforms. I'm on Twitter at SBakerMD. I'm on YouTube at SeanBakerMD. I'm on TikTok, SeanBakerMD. I'm on Instagram, SeanBaker1967. My name is SHAWNBAKER1967. Rivero, obviously, I meet with, I have a meeting with Rivero clients, weekly, which is cool. And then I'm also at carnivore.diet, which are where I'm heading right now to go meet with my carnivore diet community. So those are the places where I can be found.
I hope you enjoyed this interview. Now you need to watch this video next with Laura Spath, all about how to get the best carnivore results and what she did wrong on the carnivore diet and how to fix it. I'll see you guys next week.